You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. And this is the concert and entertainment calendar for Wednesday, January 26th. Please check with individual venues for any cancellations or postponements. Tonight, Riley Walker at the Gray Eagle, an evening with Nellie McKay at Isis Music Hall, Disclaimer stand-up lounge comedy open mic at Asheville Music Hall, and karaoke with KJ Tara Ware. Tomorrow, Thursday, January 27th, Jeremy Boger and the Golden Eagles at Gray Eagle, Asheville Session featuring Reggie Hedden at Isis Music Hall, Dirty Logic at Asheville Music Hall, Matt Water and the Recipe at One World West, Karaoke Takeover at the Auditorium, Railroad Earth at the Orange Peel, Bluegrass Jam with Drew Madeluk and the Boys at Jack of the Wood, Gospel Night with Provision at Double Crown, and Citizen Scholar, The Beatles and Gender featuring Lizette Gallagher at Citizen Vinyl. And on Friday, January 28th, L1011 at Gray Eagle, Rainbow Girls at the Isis Music Hall Lounge, Bluegrass with Christy Cox at Isis Music Hall Main Stage, Duffery, Samatos, Pathway, Trinity Justice, and Druid at Asheville Music Hall, Guided by Pigs at One World West, Yo Mama's Big Fat Booty Band, Dr. Ock, and the Golden Beats at Salvage Station, Perversions at the Auditorium, The Utility Players at Jack of the Woods, Slow Packer and Nostalgianoid at American Vinyl Company, and Contagious at Silverado's. The concert and entertainment calendar airs every day at 12, 3, and 6 p.m. Tune in then or visit ashevillefm.org to keep up to date with what's going on around town. ...103.3 Asheville FM can now announce a birthday, anniversary, thank employees, or announce an event on air, maybe even on your favorite show or shows. Since it's a form of sponsorship, it's 100% tax deductible, and you'll be supporting 103.3 Asheville FM at the same time. Contact Robert at ashevillefm.org for more information. Asheville. It's just after 6 o'clock on Wednesday, January 26th, and this is the AFM News Hour. I'm News Team Correspondent Coco Garcia. The AFM News Hour theme music is composed by local artist The Alushatistos. Views and opinions expressed on the AFM News Hour do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM. For questions, feedback, story suggestions, and more, please email us at news@ashevillefm.org. For these stories and more, find us on Facebook at Asheville FM. On tonight's edition of the AFM News Hour, in tonight's Healthy Asheville Report, News Team correspondent Dick Needleman will update us on COVID-19 policies, precautions, and statistics in the city. Earlier today, Asheville Blade editor David Forbes joined News Team correspondent KP Whaley to discuss last night's City Council meeting. And earlier today, News Team correspondent Patricia Furnish and News Team correspondent Patricia Furnish spoke with Sarah Hart, the communications manager for ASAP, to discuss winter farmers market options. But first, let's take a look at this week's headlines. In local news, in a press release from the city government, for safety and to reduce the transmission of COVID-19, Asheville City Council meetings will remain in remote format and accessible to the public. These remote format City Council meetings are a temporary measure for the health and safety of everyone, taking into consideration guidance from the CDC, the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, and the Buncombe County Health and Human Services. Following several months of strife with the houseless community, the city of Asheville released a press release on January 18th regarding the community-wide issue. The city is responding daily while also working with partners on long-term solutions to address homelessness. They will continue to address criminal behavior as well as increased monitoring and cleanup of parks and other public property. Asheville has procedures it implements when homeless camps occur on public or privately owned property, with safety of the campers, the general public, and staff always being the highest priority. According to the release, encampments are unsafe and not solutions to homelessness. In the delivery of daily responses, a long-term solutions to homelessness, the Homeless Initiative Advisory Board's regular meeting is on January 28th at 9 a.m. A woman who was being detained at the Buncombe County Detention Center has died, according to a sheriff's office, marking the fifth such death at the jail within a year and the sixth within 16 months. The Buncombe County Sheriff's Office said in a news release that Maria Christina Frisbee, 41, was jailed on Tuesday evening on multiple drug charges and for felony possession of a stolen motor vehicle. Sheriff's Office spokesperson Aaron Sarver said Frisbee was on a special watch, which the news release said was based on her previous booking history and history of drug use. A detention officer was conducting supervision rounds at around 8:30 p.m. and saw a detainee acting erratically in a holding cell. The officer went into the holding cell and summoned medical help and supervisors. After a check by the nurse, emergency medical services arrived at the detention center at 8:45 p.m. Frisbee died at 11:46 p.m. at the Mission Hospital. Programming support is brought to you by our contributing listeners and by Assembly Required. They are presenting the Asheville Designer Toy Expo February 5th and 6th at Wicked Weed Funkatorium in Asheville. The focus is the artist and their art, with mediums ranging from resin, vinyl, wood, and ceramic. Info can be found at assembly-required.net. Health reporter Dick Needleman will update us on COVID-19 policies, precautions, and statistics in the city in tonight's Healthy Asheville Report.
Hi, I am Dick Needleman, health reporter with this week's Healthy Asheville Health Report. I've got a big report this week of five COVID-related events that have occurred in Buncombe County, in North Carolina, and in our country. These topics include infections, hospitalizations, ICU admissions, testing, and face masks. In local news, on January 11th, the Department of Health and Human Services and Public Health Director Stacy Saunders posted the weekly Buncombe County COVID-19 Community Update. She said that, quote, "This is the time for people in the community to think about how to reduce your risk and protect your health. This should include limiting interactions with others when possible," unquote. There is an increase in the COVID-19 case rate, hospitalizations, and ICU admissions this week. The case rate is up by 40%. Percent positivity is rapidly rising to 20%, well above the 5% level, indicative of a high transmission rate. Unvaccinated people represent 80% of the hospitalizations and 88% of ICU admissions due to COVID-19 in North Carolina. The Department of Health and Human Services recommends that everyone should get vaccinated and boosters when eligible, get tested if exposed to someone with COVID-19 or have symptoms, wear a mask correctly when in public indoor spaces. Stacy Saunders declares that, quote, "Our community is working hard to support testing and vaccination needs," unquote. Vaccination sites, testing sites, and home testing kits can be located through the Department of Health and Human Services. On January 18th, the Department of Health and Human Services and Public Health Director Stacey Saunders posted the weekly Buncombe County COVID-19 community update. She said that, quote, "Omicron is certainly showing us its power to infect our community and communities across the U.S., unquote. There is an increase in the COVID-19 case rate, hospitalizations, and ICU admissions this week. The case rate is up by 26%. Last week it was up by 40%. Percent positivity is rising to 22.9%, well above the 5% level, indicative of a high transmission rate. Most new cases are between the ages of 25 to 49, and children ages 0 through 17 have the second largest number of new cases. Unvaccinated people represent 77% of the hospitalizations and 87% of ICU admissions due to COVID-19 in North Carolina. The Department of Health and Human Services recommends get vaccinated and boosters when eligible. Get tested if exposed to someone with COVID-19 or have symptoms. Stay at home if you are not feeling well, even with a negative COVID test. Wear a mask when in public indoor spaces. Vaccination sites, testing sites, and home testing kits can be located through the Department of Health and Human Services. A new federal government policy allows every home in the U.S. to order 4 free at-home COVID tests. To make a request, go to www.covidtests.gov. In health news about face masks, at the January 5th media question and answer session, Buncombe County Public Health Director Stacey Saunders encouraged the use of medical-grade face masks over cloth masks. At the recent January 12th media question and answer session, she said that the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has recently sent N95 medical-grade face masks to Buncombe County. These masks will be distributed with 5,000 newly arrived home testing kits. Buncombe County will join Milwaukee, New York City, Salt Lake City, and Connecticut in giving out free N95 face masks to its residents. Wearing a face mask is still considered one of the most important public health measures to lessen the spread of COVID-19. It needs to be worn correctly over the nose and mouth to be effective. In response to the recent surge of infections, the Buncombe County Board extended the face mask policy for indoor public spaces, and on January 14th, the CDC posted new guidelines that cloth masks are not as effective as surgical masks or N95 respirators. The agency recommends that Americans, quote, wear the most protective mask that fits well and that you can wear consistently, unquote. An N95 respirator is considered the gold standard of medical-grade face masks for the ability to block 95% of very small particles and 99.8% of smaller particles the size of the COVID-19 virus because of its high filtration capacity and snug facial fit. In contrast, two-layer cotton masks only stop 40 to 60%. N95s has also been shown to be the most effective face covering at suppressing the transmission of the more contagious Delta and Omicron strains. In a recent op-ed in the Washington Post, the authors write that, quote, the masks are easy to breathe in, and they're easy to find now, too, unquote. The KN95 mask is a face covering that looks similar to the N95 and is almost as effective. KN95 masks are better than surgical masks and cloth masks. In health news about free at-home COVID-19 tests. On January 14th, the White House announced that all Americans can order free at-home COVID-19 tests at covidtests.gov beginning January 19th. Last month, the Biden administration purchased 500 million rapid antigen at-home test kits in response to a shortage due to the recent surge of infections. The United States Postal Service will send 4 free test kits to valid residential addresses and will ship them in 7 to 12 days. Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz posted a tweet that said, quote, I just ordered at-home COVID tests and it was super easy, unquote. The website opened one day early in order to identify any glitches and already had hundreds of thousands of hits by early evening. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that, quote, We can't guarantee there won't be a bug or two, unquote. People living in different units in the same apartment building have reported to be rejected because of duplicate addresses. The federal government website recommends that people should take an at-home test if they have had symptoms, or at least 5 days after they come in close contact with someone with COVID-19, or before they gather with people who are not fully vaccinated and boosted or at risk for severe disease. The free at-home tests can be easily obtained by phone or at the pharmacy. The federal government plans to set up a call line to order the tests. Per a recent federal government policy, private health insurance is required to cover the cost up to $12 per test and up to 8 tests a month. In health news about free COVID tests and face masks, federal, state, and county government have recently started programs to facilitate the distribution of free at-home tests and free N95 medical-grade face masks to all Americans in response to the increased demand for tests and masks due to the recent surge of COVID-19 infections. At the January 19th media question and answer session, Buncombe County Public Health Director Stacy Saunders said that the county will distribute 5,000 free at-home COVID test kits with free N95 face masks. One half of the supply will be distributed to equity-focused community organizations, and the other half will be distributed to the general population. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has begun programs for free PCR tests. At-home tests can be ordered on their website, and in-person testing is offered at UNCA. A January 19th county newsletter said that, quote, in response to high demand for testing and a surge in COVID-19 cases, more testing opportunities are opening up in Buncombe County, unquote. More information on COVID testing in Buncombe County is available on the Health and Human Services website. On January 14th, the White House announced a new federal program that will allow all Americans to order free at-home COVID-19 tests at covidtests.gov, beginning January 19th. On January 19th, the White House announced a new federal program that will make free, high-quality, medical-grade N95 face masks available to all Americans at pharmacies and community health centers nationwide. The federal government encourages each person to wear the most protective mask because of the recent highly contagious Omicron strain. Quote, we know that these masks provide better protection than cloth masks, unquote, said Dr. Tom Inglesby, the administration's COVID testing coordinator. This has been Dick Needleman with the Healthy Asheville Health Report. Let's keep Asheville healthy. For questions, feedback, comments, and more, please email me at healthyasheville@ashevillefm.org.
That was Dick Needleman with tonight's Healthy Asheville Report. Asheville City Council met last night to discuss hotels and climate justice, to name a few topics. They were also met with a large turnout of public comment on a topic not on the agenda. Asheville Blade editor David Forbes joined News Team correspondent KP Whaley earlier today to explain.
David Forbes, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time again.
Always a pleasure.
City Council made some moves last night, or tried to.
Well, it was interesting. I think it was more that the public, they tried to sneak something through and the public made a lot of moves pretty effectively, I'll say, against it. So some context, as listeners may be aware, the city of Asheville has been escalating a lot of like really brutal and draconian policies against houseless people lately, and against other people who are, you know, speaking up against these policies. Infamously, there was the raid on the Aston Park houseless camp, where, to full disclosure, two Asheville Blade journalists were arrested for trying to cover that. And those arrests have been condemned by the Committee to Protect Journalists, and, you know, obviously also by us. So, since then, since the last council meeting, where council said some just open, some of the members said some openly classist things and kind of backed the police on the recent camp raids, which have been going on for well over a year now, they one of the police officials, Mike Lamb, mentioned they might consider restrictions or banning distribution of food. Now, this police have done this have run into a lot of hurdles, justifiably, including the First Amendment, for one thing, like prohibiting people from giving things to other people is, you know, not supposed to be a thing the governments can do, with very rare exceptions, legally anyway. So, after that, there was a wave of after the fact arrests. A lot of people were arrested on what are clearly pretty absurd felony littering charges for having art supplies in the public park during one of the protests. Very clear retaliation intended to intimidate people. Recently, last week, news emerged through B-Love and then reported in a little more depth by the Asheville Free Press initially that city staff and part of city council had already considered this a ban on food and supply distribution. And to be clear, like most bans, this, you know, there's some like legalese and some exceptions. But basically, this would require really restrictive permits for giving out food. It turned out it would ban handing out supplies entirely. You know, a lot of food distributions they also give out, you know, say warming pads or menstrual products,
diapers,
basic like health supplies. Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You know, maybe even tent sleeping bags in some cases. We could entirely ban that. So the boy we've been referring to this as a ban. It is. And when language emerged, you know, it's funny because initially the city was trying to deny that they were, you know, considering this. It emerged pretty quickly that they actually were. We reported on their initial kind of attempts Monday to kind of spin this. And even then on its face, the official that hired to spin it actually just came from Fox News. Interesting note, literally just was a Fox News bureau chief for a while. Was hired directly from there. But but this basically said, oh, we're not looking to restrict food in parks, but we are going to set up like a system of restrictive permits run by the same people who are doing camp evictions. So on the face of it, didn't make much sense. It turned out that at one of their check-in sessions, which are these really vague behind-the-scenes things where three council members and the city manager kind of check in with each other, they've increasingly come away for them to just kind of like make policy behind the scenes. They had already presented a fully written out ordinance that, yeah, was severely restrictive, did make it nearly impossible for most existing food distribution efforts to work, did like entirely ban supply distribution. So word got out, obviously, and you end up having a huge public backlash. And the meeting itself didn't see a huge amount. Last night, the public comment was really where things happened. You had 35 people who ended up speaking,
mm-hmm.
Which for considering they've made it very hard to sign up for remote meetings and speak, you have to go through this long process of forms and there's a lot of technical glitches usually, is pretty incredible. That's an unusual amount of people for this particular time period.
Yeah. Yeah. And did everyone get to speak? Cause we've seen some problems around that too.
So that was actually interesting. Council has been, and the mayor especially is, and you know, there's a whole piece that we did last year, Matilda Bliss report on for the Blade called Adjourned, which is an in-depth investigation into all of the ways city council has tried to restrict or stop or public comment, sometimes breaking open meetings laws in the process. I encourage people to go read that if you want a little more information on this topic. But the mayor Esther Mannheimer is notorious for just like really disliking the idea of the public speaking up at all, especially if they're criticizing the city, which they often are these days. Mm. So she actually wanted to cap public comment at 1 hour, which considering 35 speakers, each of them ostensibly get as much as 3 minutes, would obviously like leave a lot of people, like not able to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But Councilor Kim Roney, who's been the only member to oppose the sweeps, though, until recently, this meeting got a little more assertive about that, but had been somewhat tepid on that opposition in the past. But this time was very much like more outspoken and said, no, like we need to hear from everyone. We have a short meeting. We've had a fairly short meeting, and they actually prevailed in this case. The people who wanted like to allow everyone to speak. And so, yeah, all the speakers got their 3 minutes.
Great. Great. So what happens with that whole issue then right now?
So it's interesting because Roney proposed that
the city attorney said, oh, you know, we're not, you know, seriously considering it, which is, I would say, laughably false. I have to just, you know, not just as an individual and, you know, a leftist, but like as a journalist, that does not go with the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
City governments do not draft up detailed legal language for fun, you know,
and put it
and
on
they
a
don't
shelf.
Present a city council fund. If they do that, that is a proposal they want to do.
Right. And they don't put it on a shelf and leave it there.
Yeah, exactly. They don't just run around doing that randomly. There was clearly some like thought and research that went into this. The police official last meeting hinted at they were going to do this. You know, it is for a government that seems mostly driven by just really wanting to get any sign of poverty out of the sight of tourists. It's a ugly and evil but very obvious step. But I do think they underestimated the amount of opposition it was going to get, or that like it was going to get the notice that it did as early as it did. But so they said, oh, it's not immediately supposed to go to council. But I don't really think anyone bought that.
Yeah.
And there was kind of some gaslighting here from city council because they kept saying, oh, well, it's not in the agenda. And more than one speaker was like, we know it's not, but we know y'all rush policies through very quickly,
mm-hmm.
often after like brewing them behind the scenes. So we're trying to, one speaker used the term, cut out the cancer, like get it dealt with early, stop this early. Roney proposed just scrapping the idea entirely. The city making a firm commitment they would not ever research again or bring this idea back up. She
amazing.
Get a lot of support on that.
Yeah.
Councilmember Sage Turner was pretty vocal that she did want this brought up, which is interesting. Turner is we've reported on the blade before, has a history of, in her role as one of the senior managers at the French Broad Food Co-op, actually has a record of like workers saying that she had labor violations there, mm-hmm. and lives in a like $600,000 five bedroom house. So this is a dynamic we see again in this situation. People who are in positions of incredible wealth and privilege really getting aghast the idea that poor people would like have a place to sleep or food to eat. And I guess one of the dynamics that is getting people so enraged about this.
Yeah. So I guess we just kind of have to keep our eyes on council and see if this comes up again.
I think we do. And interesting, I would encourage people actually, and granted, I watch way more different meetings than is healthy, but in this case, I think even general members of the public should go. It's on the city's YouTube channel, but like, seeing the outrage of the people who spoke, you know, people using terms like tyranny. One speaker even asked council how they sleep at night.
Mm.
People call for the city manager's, you know, removal. You had a long time, you know, people who have spent a long time in like houseless services, like decrying this. And it's been interesting because you haven't just seen like, you know, this has been a broad base of people against this. Everyone from like, you know, Episcopal churches and Carolina Jews for Justice to like leftists and anarchists and just long time like people who've worked providing like food to houseless people. I think one reason they were trying to do this behind the scenes, I think they kind of had some idea of how unpopular it was going to be, but I don't think they really knew. As a matter of fact, after public comment, you had a real interesting exchange that was the mayor and vice mayor Shanika Smith were outraged, but they weren't outraged that, you know, this idea had got, or any of the concerns the public had brought up. They were outraged that people had spoken up about this.
Mm-hmm.
They said it hurt the integrity of city council for like news of this to emerge early, even though it's a public record that, you know, they were discussing this and this proposal had been drafted up. And I do think it's kind of very telling that like this council is way more concerned about not as nearly that concerned about like actual poverty and desperation. They are really concerned if people speak up about the terrible things they're doing to worsen it.
Right.
That's really where they get outraged.
They get outraged about perception because
exactly.
They don't want to be seen as
God forbid someone spoke up without their say-so.
As what they're doing, right.
Yeah, exactly. And interestingly, on this front, something else actually emerged in public comment, which I think does bear watching. There is a city proposal to, and we have the language on this too. They've already drafted it out to abolish and dismantle the city's 20 plus like advisory boards, or I didn't say advisory boards, like city committees.
Wow.
And this is everything from like African American heritage, you know, human rights, monitoring the police. forestry, and now granted, these committees have not exactly like always covered themselves in glory, ironically, because of pressure from City Hall. They'll pack them with, fairly well-off people that are allied to kind of this more conservative view that comes from City Hall. City staff also try to outright intimidate them when they speak up or dissent. But occasionally, they do actually offer proposals that do dissent from City Hall or put pressure or publicly criticize officials. And that's recently happened with some of the camp sweeps. And you've seen this real effort to clamp down, and now they're proposing to abolish them entirely. That's not going over well either, obviously, as you can kind of imagine. And it does definitely seem kind of this mark of this city government that's really, even by government standards, unusually obsessed with like silence and control.
Mm. Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see how people respond to that on council, because folks like Shanika Smith and Kim Roney sort of got their chops, if you will, by being on those types of committees as citizens.
That's a really interesting point, I think. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I think that interesting speaks to like, two different directions. Definitely, Smith's politics have gone much more conservative in office. She's one of the people who was decrying unnamed councilmember, presumably Roney, for like speaking up about this issue to the press and quote unquote leaking information, even though the information is public record.
Mm-hmm.
I think to some degree, I know that they're really aggrieved even that Roney has done fairly mild, and they are generally pretty mild until very recently, criticisms. And I know a number of the staff didn't like Roney when she was a transit committee member, mm-hmm. Which is kind of where she got her political start. And notably, it was not just her, to be clear. There are a lot of other transit committee members that were not from the demographics city committees usually draw from and tend to be much more vocal about the way that city policy around transit hurt their communities or lack of transit.
Right.
But I think as far as they want to cut off that pipeline, they would, under this proposal, they replace it with four very vague, like advisory groups on things like, a well-planned community is one of them, which who knows what that means. City Hall uses it to mean everything from like hotels to more cops.
Right.
So probably doesn't bode very well, but it replaces these much more specific groups that deal with specific topics with these very vague groups that are much smaller and like the city staff and council have a lot more direct control over. So it definitely prevents like somewhat, a city committee causing bad headlines for them, because that's most of what they seem to be concerned about.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I appreciate your reporting and keeping an eye on these things so we do know about them. There was actually some things on the agenda, though.
Yeah.
a hotel, of course. We couldn't have a meeting without a hotel.
Yes.
And also, I believe they talked about climate justice. You want to fill us in on those things?
Sure. Climate justice, it was interesting. The climate justice plan, it's interesting because compared to like their crackdown on the houseless last meeting, did not get as nearly as huge amount of attention. More kind of left-leaning transit certainly part of it. Climate advocates have actually praised this plan. But it's interesting because it comes with a lot of caveats. Sunrise Movement, for example, which actually did a sit-in at City Hall on wanting better climate policy, was some of the people speaking up about this later in the meeting. And it looks good on paper, seems to be kind of what you were hearing from climate activists. And ironically, some of the same activists spoke later in the meeting and were against like the policies against the houseless and against distributing food. So I do think it's kind of, again, this interesting gap between like on paper, the city is committing to, taking climate seriously, but it's money. But as some of the same activists who helped, push the city to adopt something like this pointed out, like their actions tell a different story.
Mm-hmm.
One of the speakers last night even said, like, when are you going to do what you say you want to do? So I do think kind of that tension is kind of interesting. Also, like they're moving to abolish the city committee that deals with sustainability, at the same time. So we'll see where it goes. I see these things being implemented.
Yeah, we should mention it's a pretty aggressive climate policy in terms of, carbon emissions, in less than 10 years sort of eliminated.
If they do it.
Yeah. So I sort of wonder if that statement from the committee is true. Like, when are you going to start doing this? Because we only have 8 years to go to meet those goals.
Exactly. And honestly, you know, I mean, as someone who's covered city government for far longer than is probably healthy for any human being, they make plans all the time. And sometimes they say things that are terrible. Sometimes they say things that are actually, like, on paper, fairly laudable. However, if anyone in the city struggling to survive can see the direction they've gone, it has not matched with any of the policies other than the ones that are most dedicated to gentrification. I can't think of a single case where they've actually tried to implement, like, in full one of the plans that calls for, like, more sweeping environmental or social stuff. Reparations is another good example. We've seen them repeatedly cut back to the point where they're now saying that won't even involve, like, land or money, which is what actual reparations means. But yeah, like, okay, the city's committed to carbon emissions. They're still pouring money into the police department, which actually emits a lot because they have vehicles running around all the time and over-policing people or policing, you know, and terrorizing people. So, you know, and it was interesting that some of the same people who pushed for the city to adopt a more aggressive climate policy then were turning around later in the meeting and saying, you know, all the other policies you're pursuing are exactly against this. We need you to do what you actually say you want to do.
Right.
So, yeah, and it's interesting. We are heading into election season, and who knows how it'll turn out. There is certainly a lot of pressure exerted to keep candidates who are at all even slightly critical of the city hall status quo for even running. We've seen that before. At the same time, like, if someone was a, like, aspiring politician, fraught a path as that is, and we're looking around, I don't see how they would read there isn't a lot of blood in the water from city hall status, you know, like city hall's like kind of establishment after last night. The public was clearly very enraged and very angry and does not like city council as a whole very much at all. So, you know, who knows if any candidates will seize on that anger and kind of like, you know, try to reflect that in any of their policies. So far, we haven't seen much of that. Only one candidate, to my knowledge, Andrew Fletcher, has even condemned the arrest of the journalists and activists, but, and locals that were just happened to be there at the Aston Park camp. But like, but it is, you know, it is notable though, that the tenor is changing. This is probably the most outraged I've seen the public overall at City Hall. That's not new, but it's not going away. For about the past 2 years, it's just been escalating.
Right. Wow. Hotels, we can't have a meeting without a hotel discussion.
No, we can't. I think it's ceremonial at this point. They have to approve a hotel every meeting. So this actually was an old hotel or an old hotel proposal. And it's interesting, as a matter of fact, it was one of the proposals that we took aim at in the piece, The Tourism Machine, which Matilda Bliss wrote, is a really in-depth analysis of the tourism industry in Asheville and the hotel industry specifically. And it's, you know, it's right down Biltmore Avenue. It's right near the beginning of Southside, which is a historic, mostly black, but neighborhood that the city is really pushing gentrification into pretty hard. And it was supposedly got a lot of controversy at the time, but it did eventually end up passing. And they were just coming back wanting some exceptions, want to change the plans up a little bit. And actually, the city waived them through. You know, if anything, I think it is a testament to how conservative city council was gone. And they were never great, but like this council, you know, this would have been a big political fight even a year or two ago on city council. We've had probably like a 4-3 vote, maybe a 5-2 at best. And this time it just sailed through.
Wow. Any other activity you want to talk about before we wrap up?
Oh, I think that's a gracious plenty. Yeah. I mean, I encourage people to visit AshevilleBlade.com. We have a lot of recent, we had, you know, a detailed account of the Christmas night crackdown, you know, we have more coverage coming. Obviously, you know, if people want some more Asheville government stuff, if you follow me on Twitter, just at David Forbes, or Matilda Bliss, who's also covers city government a lot, which is, you know, just at Matilda_Bliss. So that's, yeah, we tend to do a lot of live coverage over there and a lot of kind of breaking news coverage. So, I'd encourage people to, you know, if they want to know more, we've got more information.
Great. Thank you again, David, for joining us. Appreciate your time as always.
Always pleasure.
That was News Team correspondent KP Whaley speaking with Asheville Blade editor David Forbes. The Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture The Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project, or ASAP, has winter farmers markets operating in Buncombe County. SNAP participants also can double their dollars at ASAP farmers markets at AB Tech. Sarah Hart, the communications manager for ASAP, spoke with News Team correspondent Patricia Furnish about winter hours, the double your dollars options, and shopping tips.
This is Patricia Furnish for Asheville FM News. Today I'm joined by Sarah Hart. She's the communications manager for ASAP, and that's the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So, Sarah, I recently saw some information about farmers markets in Buncombe County, and they're offering year-round local shopping. Can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, what is ASAP?
Yeah, so ASAP is an organization, and our mission is to help local farms thrive, link farmers to markets and supporters, and build healthy communities through connections to local food. So fitting in with that is working with farmers markets. We support about, within season, we support about 100 markets throughout the Appalachian grown region, which is Western North Carolina and some neighboring states as well. About 10 of those are in Buncombe County and open during sort of the height of the season. But this year, what's very exciting is that, we often have had winter markets or year-round markets, but it does feel like we've got a few more options for them this year than sometimes we've had in the past. So that's an exciting thing. I think year over year, we see more farmers and markets selling into the winter because of the demand that people have for local food, and farmers meet that demand by getting high tunnels or greenhouses or, you know, changing their farming practices so that they can extend the season into the colder months.
I see here that you've got winter months of January to March. Is it any more specific than that as to when the winter month will end in March?
Sure. It varies for, like I said, there's about 10 different markets that operate with different seasons in Buncombe County. ASAP runs one of those markets, the ASAP Farmers Market, which is currently operating at AB Tech. That is formerly Asheville City Market, which was downtown on North Market Street. We moved due to the pandemic to have more space and called it the ASAP Farmers Market at AB Tech. If all goes according to plan, we will be moving back downtown and become Asheville City Market again in April. So that'll be when our winter market will end at the end of March. I think March 26th is that last date. The first Saturday in April, that market will open up, you know, in our full season again. Likewise, the River Arts District Farmers Market is at Plebe Urban Winery. They operate there year-round, although when it is the winter markets, they go more inside, and in the summer markets, in the summer and months, they're more of their vendors are outside. I think their winter market technically, I think, ends at the end of April, and in May is when they call it their new season. But since the location is very similar, the line between that isn't super noticeable. So that feels like a market that runs year-round. The Weaverville Tailgate Market did move to a new indoor location for their winter market that they're offering inside the Weaverville Community Center. They, I think, will go back to an outdoor location come April, but sometimes that does change a little bit from year to year. So one thing that ASAP really tries to do is keep putting out press releases and keep putting out updates. And we have a website where you can check all the farmers markets in the region and try to keep that updated as opening dates and locations sometimes shift as markets are finding the right parking lot to be in this year.
SNAP participants can double their dollars at ASAP Farmers Market at AB Tech. Can you tell us a little bit about what is SNAP, and then what is this offer of doubling the dollars?
Yeah, so SNAP is a federal program. It's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It goes by a number of different names. It's been called EBT. It's called food stamps. SNAP is I think its primary name is a federal program right now, and that's where people can use SNAP dollars to buy food at grocery stores. And something that ASAP over the past 10 years has really worked to do is help farmers markets be able to accept SNAP. That process, because it is a federal process, sometimes is a little more than what the capacity of a farmers market often, you know, some may be led by a volunteer manager or a very part-time manager. Has been difficult to undertake. So ASAP's really helped a lot of farmers markets in the region be able to accept SNAP. And then in the past 2 years, on top of that, we are not the only SNAP incentive program in the region. There are other programs that either have incentives or doubling program, but ASAP was able to institute a double SNAP program at 8 different farmers markets, including the ASAP market in the region. And in the only one of those markets in Buncombe County that is still operating for the winter is ASAP Farmers Market. But Transylvania Farmers Market in Transylvania County is also offering the double SNAP program. They're also a year-round market. So that is another market outside of Buncombe, but in the region where those double SNAP dollars you can still use. And that's exactly what it sounds like. Essentially, you go to the market booth and you have $10 on your SNAP card, you get $20 in tokens to spend with the vendors. And that's all covered by, you know, different sources coming in, but it's not the farmers donating that. I feel like that's a very important other aspect of the program is that it's creating a bigger market and new customers for farmers. It's not cutting into their profits. It's building on their profits and helping them develop those relationships. And lots of SNAP and double SNAP customers become regular shoppers at farmers markets and regular shoppers with the farms. So it's been a really exciting program to have grow exponentially in the last 2 years.
If someone is new to a farmers market shopping experience, because many people may be more used to going into a store, kind of a brick and mortar store, and what is a farmer's market experience like, and why might it be a viable alternative to the habitual kind of going to the grocery store?
Sure. I think that's something that a farmer's market we really see as a community space, a meeting place, a place to meet friends, a place to create relationships with the people who are growing your food. But it is also a place that more and more you can get just about your whole shopping list. I mean, certainly you're not going to find a bag of flour or sugar, but farmers have the amount of variety of what you can buy in our region has grown so much in the past 10 to 20 years. And even in the past few years, I talked about that season extension and farmers really responding to that desire for local food by growing further into the season. So you're going to see, even at these winter markets right now, you're going to see greens like from kale and collards to tender lettuce greens, spinach. You're going to see multiple varieties of that. You're going to see squash. You're going to see sweet potatoes, carrots, turnips, radishes, and then sort of specialty products. You're going to see mushrooms, microgreens. You're going to see meats from everything from, you know, chicken, beef, pork, lamb. You're going to see eggs. Lots of different kinds of cheese, lots of great artisan breads. And then farmers markets are also, we've got lots of vendors selling, you know, prepared food that you can take home, whether that's frozen dumplings, frozen pot pies, or, condiments or spice blends that are usually made with local products. You can treat yourself, buy a donut at the farmers market. You know, there's plenty of sweets and good stuff. There too. So there's a really wide variety. And I think that's a really amazing thing we've seen grow, just grow and grow and grow in our region is how much you can buy at the farmers market and that you really can do a significant portion of your weekly shopping there, depending on, maybe more so in the summer, spring, summer, fall months than in the winter, but still there's an enormous amount of variety at markets now. So you go to a farmers market, different farmers are set up it, under tents generally in, you know, for their different tables. We often, you know, I often say to a first time market goer, you know, do a loop, go and kind of look and see what everybody has and then do your shopping. And there's certainly schools of thought on go and see what you're inspired to buy and then go home and figure out what to do with it or go with a list and know that you need, you know, some kind of green to make a salad, sometimes a green to cook with into a stew, you know, the and then be flexible in terms of like, okay, so you couldn't find butter lettuce, but there's these really tender romaine leaves. So that's sort of my shopping, my farmer's market shopping tip. Farmers like to talk about their products. So if you don't know what something is, or you don't know what to do with it, ask. You know, sometimes it's busy. It might be harder to get to them if there's a line, but most farmers at markets tend to be very, very chatty about what they're selling and what they like to do with it.
A farmer's market experience, based on my experiences, can be a little intimidating at first because, again, it's a new environment. Sometimes there's a lot of hustle and bustle, and sometimes, you know, it depends upon the time when you're going, right? And then also it depends upon how much you know about that item or the produce or whatever. You might discover something new and say, I'm not really sure what that is. I need to know more. But it definitely struck me as more interactive. And that's very different from a typical grocery store experience, where really the only time you might interact with somebody in a grocery store is if you can't find something. And so that the farmer's market experience is a completely different paradigm. Could you talk a little bit more about that approach to people buying their produce, their goods, and from flowers to soap? I've seen a range of things that people walk around with, and the interaction with the vendor.
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, you're absolutely right. It is so much more of an interactive experience. And that's one of the things that we really like to talk about, is that you are able to develop a relationship with or a knowledge of the person who grows your food. And, you know, that can be true of just one time you asked about something, you know, what is kohlrabi, and the farmer told you, or, you know, if you shop regularly at the farmer's market, you may learn that you like to shop at certain farms because they either have the produce that you want, or you just like, you know, I shopped there and I want to say hi, so I'll buy something again. But that interactive element is, we think, such a motivation for people to understand their food and to want to cook food and feed themselves well. And, you know, we think of farmers markets as such healthy environments, and we don't mean that just because there's lots and lots of vegetables and you're supposed to eat those to be healthy, but because it is a time to think about and get excited about your food and see other people around you being excited about food. Certainly, meeting friends at farmers markets, maybe a little bit less so in the pandemic years, but really thinking about, you know, a farmers market is a place where you can both have a social engagement and get, you know, check off some of your to-do list for the week, because you can get some groceries in a way that maybe you would, but you are less likely to say, can you meet me at Ingles to go do our shopping together? Although maybe. So I think that interactive element, and like you said, that also can be a little bit intimidating, or to if you don't regularly shop at the market, or if it seems like everybody else knows what to do and you don't. So markets have information booths. That's where you would go to get your SNAP tokens if you were getting SNAP tokens. That's also where you can go to just use your credit card to buy tokens if you want to buy use tokens to shop with individual vendors. Most vendors now, initially, a while back, most vendors would take cash and you had to go to the market table to use your credit card to buy tokens. During the pandemic, most vendors have expanded to also accept cards. So that's a little less of a, but starting your market visit at the market information booth, finding it, which is usually going to be somewhere central within the market, farmers market managers, you know, time allowing, would love to point you in the right direction, or even offer you a tour. Or sometimes there are recipes or produce seasonality cards to let you know what to expect at that market information table. And ASAP tries to provide those resources as well. We write a weekly column on what to expect at tailgate market reports. That's available as a newsletter that ASAP sends, and the Citizen Times generally prints it in their Friday paper. So just giving a sense of what, you know, what markets are open, what they have available, and all of that can kind of demystify a little bit of that initial overwhelm. But I think push past the overwhelm, go to the market information table, do that loop to see what's at the market, and then loop back again to see what you might want to purchase.
it sounds to me like, based on your description, that you probably have people who are regulars and very kind of conversant. And then there may be new folks who would really probably want to do a little research or prep if they can in advance, because that they could either go into, like you said, the Friday edition of the Citizen Times and find out more, or they can go to the information, you used to call it the information table or booth. Sounds like that there's a way to kind of be oriented, because especially if there's a lot of activity, it could be sort of like, whoa, I don't know where to begin. Do you have any suggestions about peak times, maybe to as a first time person, when it might be best to go?
Yeah, I think definitely you see a morning rush, like with the Saturday. So some of these markets are weekday afternoon markets, and then there is the Saturday morning market, which is the biggest of the winter markets. So, and it is open because we're staying outdoors. Again, because of the pandemic, its hours have shifted back to 10 to 1. So that's actually pretty late for a morning farmer's market. But the idea is to hopefully not have too many freezing mornings. It's definitely busy right at 10. Going at 11 can be a little bit slower. The winter markets, because there are fewer of them, that Saturday winter market is a little bit, I think, busier just for its entire 3 hours than an in-season spring market might have much more of a lull after the first hour in. I think in the weekday markets are smaller and potentially easier to navigate, although potentially, obviously not having as much available, but that can be a good way to sort of get to know your neighborhood market if that's one that you live near and it's easy for you to stop by after work or after you pick up kids from school or what have you. They can be a little bit less overwhelming just in terms of the sheer number of things that there are and the number of people walking through and all of that. I will say, with the River Arts District Market, and this is something that even I think regular market goers maybe missed when they start doing that indoor winter market, they've got some vendors inside and some vendors outside. So don't miss the produce vendors are inside. Don't miss them.
The idea that the farmers markets are offering year-round local shopping, is this something that was a goal, or is this year-round shopping been something that's been happening for years?
I think it's a slow move in that direction. And sort of some years you wouldn't know until you would look back and say, we couldn't do that 10 years ago. And I think that's not necessarily pandemic driven. I mean, ASAP certainly works to build markets and create more markets in which farmers can sell. So pushing consumer and community interest in buying that local food is always a goal of ASAP's. But I think a lot of things have worked together in our region to make this really great local food system, where the community clearly has developed and been pushed into a desire to do this local food shopping. And so in turn, farmers have, not all farmers, but many farmers have found ways to grow year round so that they can supply that demand. And I think, both of those things are definitely, it's supply and demand working over time, but definitely very visible, I would say, in the last like 3 or 4 years, where there is much more available in the winter than there has been in the past.
And what about prices? Are these the prices at farmers markets? How do they compare with, for example, prices in a grocery store, or people go to discount food grocery stores?
Yeah, and it varies. We've done some, periodically we'll do sort of secret shopper reports where we try to compare, what is the price of these 10 products at a variety of grocery stores, maybe an Ingles, a Whole Foods, and and something else. And then what is that at the farmer's market? And we find a lot of things are less expensive at the farmer's market, especially produce type things, vegetables. But there's less packaging, they haven't moved, there's just less there. So those can be a really good deal. I mean, other things like meat are much more expensive, because raising meat locally and not, going into the big meat system is much more expensive. So that's a place where, you sort of decide what your value set is, and maybe you eat less meat. Yeah. So I think you will see a variety. You'll absolutely see things that are less expensive than they would be in the grocery store, and you'll see things that are more expensive in the grocery store. And I mean, that's something we've definitely seen with the double SNAP program is people talking about how they can stretch, you know, because of the double SNAP program, they can stretch their meals so much more, or they can eat meat they feel good about because they have that doubling option.
I've been speaking with Sarah Hart. Sarah's the communications manager for ASAP, the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project. We've been talking about the winter farmers markets here in Buncombe County. Sarah, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Enjoyed talking to you.
That was Sarah Hart, Communications Manager for the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project, speaking with News Team correspondent Patricia Furnish. That about does it for the Asheville FM NewsHour. I'm Coco Garcia, and we'd like to give a special thanks to Patricia Furnish, Dick Needleman, and KP Whaley for their contributions to the NewsHour this week. Tune in every Wednesday at 6 p.m. and stay tuned next for Run That Back on Asheville FM.